What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker, photographer, and National Geographic explorer. And on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft their stories and just a little bit about their creative process, what goes into it. So my guest today is Tayo Amos. Tayo is a friend of mine from Stanford University who also happens to be an incredibly inspiring director and filmmaker who is on that LA hustle trying to make it in the movie world. After double majoring at Stanford, Tayo went on to earn her MFA in film production at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where she focused on directing. She is the winner of USC's First Look Faculty Award for Excellence in Directing, and her thesis film, On the Clock, screened at the Cannes Film Festival. And it's also on Amazon Prime. I'm going to throw the link to that in the show notes. In this conversation, I caught up with Tayo over Zoom from her house where she's developing her first feature film. We discuss her experience and key takeaways from USC Film School, what qualities make a good director, and how recent events in our country around race and diversity are pushing both our respective movie industries to take a really good, hard look in the mirror. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Tayo Amos.
Nice mic.
Thank you. Thank you. A little Audio Technica mic. I love it. Do you have like a home studio or any kind of like gear that you have at your house to do? I don't even know what you would need.
Yeah, just my laptop, man. I've just been writing a lot. So,
oh, really?
So my laptop is really my workstation. I have like Premiere and Photoshop if I need it for more like intense editing things that come by. But this is kind of like our studio space. So like my cousin, she's a designer. So there's like a lot of like thread and needles.
Yeah,
and
I noticed the thread behind you.
Like I'm in the like closet sort of.
Well, let's do an official welcome. Tayo Amos, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is so good to see you after a few years of time gone by.
Yeah, I mean, we graduated from college 5 years ago.
That's right. So 2014 grad. Did you stick around after for a co-term, or you went straight to USC?
No. So after Stanford, I did a overseas seminar in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And that class month in Amsterdam kind of prompted me to just live abroad, because I remember getting the opportunity to do that class. And it was basically an art making class. This music professor and 15 other students, we lived in a houseboat, and like just for a month, we were like making art, which was like super cool in Amsterdam.
Very cool.
And then when I knew I was accepted into that, I was kind of like, well, there's no reason to come back to America. Like, let's just stay. And I studied abroad in Barcelona my junior year, and I loved it so much. So I was like, I'm going to live in Spain. And my mom was very pleased to hear that, because this was after I did the Team Oscar opportunity my senior year, where I was, you know, selected to be a presenter at the Oscars. And so that was a really affirming kind of experience, because I was like, oh, yes, filmmaking, the industry, that's definitely what I want to do.
Yeah. I want to dive into that a little bit too.
Yeah, we can talk about that. But
before we get there, can you give the audience a little bit of background on where you're from and how you even got interested in film to begin with?
Yeah, totally. So I'm from Palo Alto. I literally was born at Stanford. My dad emigrated from Nigeria to study electrical engineering at Stanford. My parents got married at Namchu.
I didn't know that.
Yes. So, I grew up my whole life in Palo Alto, Mountain View. I mean, my family, we moved around in the Bay Area a lot, but I always went to school in Palo Alto. I went to Castalea for middle school and high school. So, like, that was home. And then I went to Stanford right across the street for college. And how I got into filmmaking, it was very organic. Growing up, I would just make kind of short films and music videos with my like friends and my siblings. And in high school, I took like my first filmmaking class and we learned Final Cut 7.
Hell yeah.
And like, we were just making stuff. Like, it wasn't good at all. But I was like, this is so fun. And I remember my senior year of high school, I did a short documentary about a barber in my neighborhood who taught himself how to read.
Wow.
So I was like, this is a great documentary. So I just like followed him around and like made a short documentary about him.
Amazing. So what were some of those early songs that you made music videos to? Because that's how I got my start too. Like I didn't even know that I had any skills with a camera until I arrived in like advanced digital media production class at Stanford. And compared to some of the other people in my class, I had like some skills and I'm like, where did this come from? And then I realized, I'm like, oh yeah, it was making music videos to like get down on it and like, and like the Temptations back in high school.
Yeah. I mean, there's two music videos that come to mind. One was like a Bubbly by Colby Calais.
Yep. Nice.
And
banger.
Such a banger. And then like one was a kind of a Christian song about home.
Uh-huh.
And I had my dad play like an abusive father and like my sister played a girl running away from home. It was very sad.
Your directorial start there.
Yeah. So I never thought about filmmaking as a career. And it's funny, like I made this short doc, played at this like very small, like high school focused documentary festival.
Mm-hmm.
And the judges were asked like, oh, what advice do you have for these budding filmmakers? And they all said, don't study film in college.
Hmm.
And I was like, what?
Interesting.
'Cause I mean, I wasn't thinking about film school. Like I didn't apply to any traditional film schools like NYU or anything like that. I was thinking about communications or international relations, and like Stanford felt like a good place to go to just kind of explore and like
why not
go to like one of the top schools in the country.
But why do you think they said that? Why do you think that is that a common piece of advice, and why do you think that's out there? Why do you think you tell that?
I think it was the best piece of advice, because I think what they were trying to say is you can always learn the tools. What people can't teach you is how to tell a story and to basically live a life. Hmm. Because if you're so focused on making films, what are you actually going to say?
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that was great advice. So I took some film classes at Stanford. I think there's something to be said about, you know, knowing film theory and production, like, you know, understanding those kind of concepts. But I took Spanish literature classes and communication classes and photography classes and anthropology classes, like just super random things that to this day still, you know, impact my point of view as a filmmaker in ways that I don't think I would have if I had just focused on like the mechanics of making a film. So,
But was it always in the kind of in the back of your mind that you might want to pursue this after Stanford, or did that kind of come afterwards when we're in Amsterdam and wanting to live in Spain?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker in some way, but I just thought of it as a hobby. I did not think of it as a career at all, because I sometimes still don't. But it's just like this idea of like, wait, like this is something I could do as a career, just never really clicked with me in college, because I knew I liked it, I knew I was good at it, but it, especially, you know, growing up in Silicon Valley, growing up with immigrant parents, this idea of like just not even seeing it being possible, because everything around me is like, yeah, doctor, lawyer, like traditional careers,
right.
And I'm like, okay, like guess that's the only way to make a living, you know?
Yeah. And I would say like Stanford has a lot of amazing programs in all sorts of places on campus, but it's also like primarily a technology school.
Yeah. I mean, people go there. I mean, my dad went there to study engineering, you know,
right.
Like people go there to study like computer science or science and like those kind of, you know, STEM fields and humanities, although they're very well done at Stanford, is not, you know, the focus.
Right.
I still remember senior year seeing flyers being like, do not start a startup. Too many. Stop it.
Cut it out.
Yeah. So, so my senior year, I had this opportunity to be at the Academy Awards through this Facebook contest that the Academy put on called Team Oscar.
Okay.
And it was wild. Like, they just flew. I made a video being like, I love movies so much. And I still remember, like, Ryan Coogler came to Stanford my junior year because he was talking about Fruitvale Station.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, he went to USC. Like, that's so cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think, like, seeing his journey and meeting him and then the Oscar situation, I was like, okay, I know I want to do this. Like, I know that that's kind of what I want to go for. And then, you know, after doing that, a lot of people expected me to, like, move down to LA and, like, do the LA thing, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, no, LA will always be there. I just feel like with the opportunity with Amsterdam and living abroad, I was like, I feel like this will be the only time in my life where I can literally just live abroad for a year, basically a gap year, and no one will judge me. So.
For sure. Well, and I think that, like, that lived experience is a super interesting point too, that you think that they were kind of getting at with that advice early on. And I've heard it in, like, the journalism world, kind of an analogous piece of advice is, like, yes, you can go to journalism school, but, like, you know, there's only so much I think you can be said for journalism school. At some point, you just have to, like, do journalism, like, go out and report. You don't need an advanced degree to do this. And there's something to be said for developing, you know, it could be like a subject matter expertise. Like, if you know science, like, really well, or if you go and you study earth systems and really understand climate change and all that kind of stuff, and then you can channel journalism as a tool for communication within that specific kind of sphere that you have developed some sort of expertise. So it's like another way of thinking about filmmaking, but also on just like your personal lived experience. This is a conversation I've had with a filmmaker recently on the show, of just like, really, you know, when you're starting to do some of that deep work to think about your own upbringing and your own personal story and what unique lens does that give you when it comes to how you see the world. So that's something that, like, I'm trying to think about a lot for me as well as I choose stories. So film school for you at USC, was that 2 years?
So it was three.
Okay, 3 years.
And it's funny, like, if you had told me while I was living abroad that I was going to be going to not just film school, but USC film school after, I would have thought you were crazy, because I was very anti-film school, very anti-LA. Like, I just fit in that. And after a year of living abroad, I went home and, you know, I got fired from my first job. I was a production coordinator at a production house.
Okay.
Like 2 months. I got fired for a really dumb reason. Basically, the reason was, like, I was, like, kind of doing my own thing. And they were like, why are you doing your own thing? You need to, like, do this job. And I'm like, can I do both? And they're like, no.
I was like, I would have been fired too. I would have been fired too.
Yeah. So I remember being fired and, like, thinking about, okay, what do I really want to do? And I remember thinking, like, I just want to delve into the craft of filmmaking. Like, I just want to, like, really focus on that. And I was like, damn, that's film school. And I mean, the biggest reason I didn't want to go was finances. It's very expensive. It's a very expensive degree.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I'm a spiritual person. I prayed about it and I just felt like, if finances was the only reason to not go, it's not a good enough reason. Mm. And I was like, that's true. I just felt that, you know, I'm good at school. I understand systems. Like, I had a great experience at Stanford and I felt like, okay, I'm the kind of creative that I feel like school and a structure, as imperfect a structure it could be, like, no film school is perfect. But having that sort of structure around the creative process would be the most beneficial for me. So yeah, I applied to a bunch of places. I actually turned USC down because my first choice was another school. Mm-hmm. And I visited, and it was just, again, a spiritual thing. I was like, this, and logically, the school made more sense for my goals and what I wanted to do than like USC, like, I guess. I just went that way and haven't looked back. So yeah, graduated last year, and yeah, I've been a year out now.
So gotcha. So I'm unfamiliar with really how film school works, and I know it seems like you're pursuing directing. Is that something that's a conscious decision that you make during film school, that you're going to be you're going to specialize in directing? Mm-hmm. And if so, what made you make that decision?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think especially when you're starting out, like, you're doing all the things, like you're shooting, you're editing, you're producing, like you're doing all these things. You just don't really know it yet. And so when I was looking at films, I enjoy and, you know, films that inspire me and filmmakers that inspire me, all of them were like directors. And I felt like that was the part of the process that I enjoyed the most, which was like thinking of that idea, thinking of the vision in my head and executing it. Mm-hmm. And of course, every kind of role kind of does that to a certain degree, like producing and editing, like, of course, but I think with directors, I feel like that idea of that skill of translating something on the page to something physical was something I was very attracted to. So with USC, their model, and that's why it was a little difficult going there at first, was they're all about like the total filmmaker. They want you to learn everything.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, we know you came here to be directors, but we're going to teach you cinematography and editing. Like, you have to do all the like basic roles first. Like, everyone takes the same classes the first year, and then you kind of specialize from there. Whereas other schools I was considering are more conservatory based. So they're like, if you go in as a director, you're going to be directing. Like, if you come in as an editor, you're going to be editing. So with USC though, they're more of the complete filmmaker. They're like, you're gonna learn everything. You're gonna learn how to hold the boom, you're gonna do sound, you're gonna learn it all.
Yeah.
So I think when going to USC, and I remember the first day of class, they're like, okay, who wants to be a director? It's like 95% of people raise their hands, and they're like, okay, well, you all need a day job skill, because not all of you guys are going to be directors. Like, they literally like kill your dreams day one. They're like, we're not going to be directors. Uh-huh. So we're going to teach you how to edit, because at least you can make money editing, or whatever the skill is. And I remember like seeing everyone's hands come up, and I'm like, I'm a direct though. I don't know what they're saying.
You guys can take all those editing roles.
You guys can do that, but I'm a direct. So.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I mean, I made it a point to I kind of freelanced as an editor before school. So I was like, I don't want to do the editing classes. Like, I learned Avid, I know how to use Avid, but I was like, I'm gonna shy away from editing jobs, producing jobs. I'm a good producer, but I was like, I feel like I'm here to hone my directing craft, and I'm just gonna focus on that. So yeah, so I think with USC, you have to be very intentional. And I was very lucky that I had the opportunity to be given directing opportunities, because USC is driven very much like a studio. They're like, okay, here are the projects that are greenlit, and we're going to find the directors to like direct these projects in these classes. So after the first year, like, you have, in order to be eligible, you have to take a directing class, and then you have to be like shortlisted. It's like a whole kind of like political process,
right?
And I remember just being like, okay, like, I will just do all the steps to make sure that I'm the most eligible for those opportunities. And I think that was really helpful. And I mean, it seems kind of dumb to say, but people have to like you, and I'm like, I think people like me, so that worked.
We love you. what qualities do you think make someone a great director?
That's a really good question. I think, because there's all these kind of ideas. And I think with the conversations of like diversity in Hollywood, there's all this idea of like what a director looks like. And people think when they think of a director, they think of, you know, white dude with a baseball cap with glasses on.
sitting in like that chair that has like,
yeah,
like
the high up
chair. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, no, I think, and like, obviously there's like, you have to be a leader. You have to be able to lead, of course. But I think this kind of singularity of vision is what makes a good director, while also, you know, being able to handle pressure and other voices. I think that is the biggest key. Because I remember doing my thesis film, again, run like a studio system. I was the director.
Was that On the Clock?
Yeah, On the Clock. Yeah, that was my thesis film. And I remember like having so much anxiety making that film, because every week we would like show dailies or show audition videos. Like they see the entire process of making the film and critique you every step of the way. And I remember being like, oh my God, like what? I feel like I'm going crazy. Like I feel like I know what I'm doing. And I was like, you know what? If I can make a good film in this class where I can protect my vision while also, you know, gleaning insight from faculty, from crew members, from other people, if I can stick this landing, then we have a shot at doing this as a career. Because I feel like directing is all about having that focus, that vision, while also not allowing the kind of outside voices and influences help your vision and not just detract from it.
So can you break down a little bit more for me what you mean by like singularity of vision? Because this mm-hmm. assuming, and we can talk a little bit about On the Clock in just a little bit, but like if you look at that for an example, you had a pretty big team from mm-hmm. what the credits looked like when I saw it. And I'm sure like everyone has a vision, right? But that doesn't mean that they should lead stuff. So like what do you mean by like singularity of vision in terms of a quality for a director?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think by singularity of vision, I think what I'm saying is being able to translate the emotional components of a story and nailing it down to its visual components in a way that can be communicated to other people so that they can jump on that vision with you. I think it's so similar to, and I think that's actually why I'm grateful I went to a place like Stanford that, you know, focuses so much on, you know, entrepreneurship and like independent thinking, because so much of making a film is very much like building a business or a startup. It's like, okay, you have this goal, you have this vision, and your goal, your job is to bring people on, because you can't do everything yourself. It's impossible.
Right.
So your goal is to bring people on, department heads, creative collaborators that understand your vision and are able to execute based on that vision. So I think a really great example of that is, you know, reading the script. A lot of people thought it was a comedy when they read the script. They were like, oh, young man trying to get tampons for his little sister. Comedy. And I'm like, no. This is actually the opposite of that. This is a cinema verite, grounded, dramatic story.
Can you give a little for the audience, just a quick synopsis on what the film On the Clock is?
Yeah. So On the Clock is a short film about a young man in East LA who has to get sanitary products for his little sister when she gets her period for the first time, but he can't afford it. And she's skipping school and he's just trying to find a solution for her, and it takes him on this whole journey that he was not prepared for. I feel like a lot of people were not on board with my vision efforts. They were like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why do you want to tell it this way? But I remember watching films, I was very inspired by kind of cinema verite sort of films like Fruitvale Station, like Mustang, like these sort of stories that follow these characters that are in really intense, dire situations, but kind of grounds it in a really relatable, emotional way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, I've seen it. I know it's possible. My job is to communicate that. So I brought all up our crew members on based on conversations. And then I had a whole lookbook and was very detailed. I was like, okay, these are the films I'm looking at, these for cinematography, this is the look I'm going for production design, this is what I'm going for, and just being able to communicate that vision and tone.
Because oh, interesting.
Being able to communicate tone, I remember talking to another director, she did the undergrad version of my thesis.
Okay.
And her film was great. She played at Cannes as well, and we were at different showcases, and her film was kind of similar in that it followed these sisters dealing with their mom, like losing a job and having to fend for themselves. And it was beautiful. It was a beautiful film. And we both talked about how difficult it was to communicate tone to our crew and our teachers, because a lot of people thought like, oh, like, why are you doing the shot this way? Like, why are you making it so wide? Like, why don't you have a close up here? Why don't you make it more steady? Like, why don't you have a steady cam? Why are you using handheld? And we both really gravitated towards kind of grittier, raw kind of storytelling where it's not perfect. You know, the camera is moving.
Yeah.
It's not perfect kind of, you know, production design or whatever, but it's real and it's raw and it's, and people connect to it. Mm. So I think that's what makes a good director, is being able to hone in on your tone and artistic sensibilities in a way that people can understand and execute, because that's like what, you know, the big dogs get paid for. Like when you think of a Tim Burton movie, you know exactly what kind of movie that is. Like you don't even have to know what the script is. You're like, okay, like that is what this man is going to do or this woman is going to do.
Yeah.
So I think that's what makes a really strong director, when you can say like, oh, Tyler Amos, okay, when I sign her on to this project, this is what she's going to do with it in a way that no one else can do.
And where do you feel like you are on your journey of kind of finding that voice as an individual director?
I'm sure for
even for people like Tim Burton, it's a lifelong journey for us all.
Oh, 100%. I feel like I am on my way for sure. That's why I went to film school, to have that time to just make some really shitty films. Like I made a lot of films before I made On the Clock. Because there's a lot of people who are like, is On the Clock your first film? And I'm like, yes, technically it's like my first film that like is on a streaming platform that did a full festival run that I like really put out there.
Yeah.
But that is not my first film. I had to do a lot. Like I look back on my first film at USC and it was not good. Like, I mean, it's not bad, but it's like, oh God. Like,
yeah.
Growth is there. So I think in terms of where I am, I definitely am like being very intentional about thinking about larger projects. I think it's very easy to get kind of stuck in like short films and music videos, which are great.
Yeah.
But I think there's definitely a point where you have to be intentional. Like I had to turn down a short film project the other day. I was like, I can't do any more shorts. I need to think of the next larger canvas so I can grow more as an artist.
Right.
So I'm really excited to do a feature project, hopefully in the near future. Obviously
cool.
With COVID, it's, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen. But the good news about this time is there's time to write. Like I wrote another script, which was like not, I was not expecting that. But just thinking about, okay, what are the stories? There's so many stories that are like in my head that I'm like, okay, I want to direct these stories, but in order to direct them, I have to write them first. So,
okay.
Let's do that.
And is that like, you know, if you have the big reputation as a director, then people will say like, hey, check out this script that some person wrote. It's amazing.
Yeah.
We'd love you to direct. But I'm guessing if you're trying to find your way and like make a name for yourself, similar to the documentary world, it's like, you got to make it happen.
Yeah, 100%. People are not checking for you like when you are starting out. And so the only way to stand out is to, you know, create your own opportunities. And I think, again, it's like that hustle mentality from both USC and Stanford. It's like, you just got to like figure it out. And so every filmmaker like that, you know, I look up to, they're like, yeah, write your scripts. Like, they rarely talk. I mean, they talk about directing, and I think there's so many ways to direct and things like that. But at the end of the day, it's like you need to have the story, the script. Like Alfred Hitchcock said, like, it's like the script. That's what makes a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, damn it, I don't like writing though. But you guys, But that's the only way to really, you know, convince people, unless you're, I mean, I guess you could have, there's certain films where, you know, they have outlines and they just kind of improvise the whole thing and like it's possible, but it just makes more sense to have a strong foundation when you're building anything, and that's the script. So at least where I'm at, I feel like I definitely see the kind of stories I want to tell, and I don't try to put too much of like, this is who I am as a director, because it, I don't want it to be, I want the work to speak for itself, kind of like a hindsight thing, mm-hmm. and allow other people to do. But I, there's definitely certain things that I gravitate towards. Like I realized like my, I just wrapped a short film. We did the sound mix yesterday, and looking at it, I'm like, I'm very proud of it, but I'm like, I just really love handheld. Like Steadicam is like, oh, like it's really hard for me to like get on the Steadicam train. So I love, I realized like I love moving the camera. Like I'm, it's not easy for me to just like have long static shots. Like I don't do that. So whatever the style you want to call that. And there's a lot of people that don't like handheld. They're like, that's messy filmmaking. Like, well, I disagree.
No, like I loved the cinematography and on the clock. I thought it was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking about, I don't even know how it was shot, the specifics of it, but like even I'm thinking about the scene where he's in the grocery store and mm-hmm. like pretty tight on like his face, like coming around the corner, and like you're like coming around the corner with him, and it gives just like a speed and momentum and intimacy with how close it is. That was really beautiful. And I want to touch on this idea of like you made a bunch of stuff that wasn't very good, and like we've all been there, and I'm sure there's a ton of people listening right now who on whatever it is, whether it's their side hustle or their main hustle, are pursuing storytelling in some form or another and not quite living up to their own taste. And it reminds me of this amazing Ira Glass quote that I love, which is like, you get into this business because you have great taste, and for a long time, you can't, like your skills don't match up to your tastes, and that is really disappointing to you because your taste is still killer, but you don't quite have what it takes to live up to that. Do you remember a moment, whether it was on the clock or something else, where you felt like, I just made something that makes me proud and lives up to my personal taste? And if so, I'm wondering, like, what is like, what are some things that were in the gap between like those films that you're look back on and you cringe versus something that you're proud of? Like what skills did you develop, or what is in there that maybe we could tease out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I love that. Like just thinking about like storytelling, the growth of storytelling. I think with On the Clock specifically, just hearing people's reactions, because any artist wants people to feel moved by their work, whether it's laughter for like comedy or crying or whatever. That's our ultimate goal as artists, is to move people. Mm-hmm. And so just hearing people tell me at multiple screenings that they cry at certain scenes, I'm like, that to me is mind blowing, because it's very hard for me to cry, especially for movies. So when someone told me like that made me cry, I was like, because that's so powerful. It's like, wow, like I was able to make something that moves someone to the level of tears. Like that is insane to me. Especially for a short film, when you only have, in this case, this film's very short. It's only 12 minutes long. With credits, it's longer. But I was like, okay, that's when you know you've made it, I guess.
Yeah.
When you're able to say like, wow, like I'm able to emotionally move people through my art. And to get there, I think it's so easy when we're looking at films, at least that you look up to, or any sort of stories you look up to, and you focus on kind of the end product. Like I've just been finishing Hamilton, like a lot of people have, like it's just gone Disney Plus. And I'm looking at this like, how the fuck did this guy do this? Like, this
I know. I just saw it for the first time too. I'm like,
right? I was supposed to see Hamilton with my sister, but COVID. Like, I was like, I guess this is the next best thing. And you listen to interviews and like, how did he do it? And it's like, I think he, and it goes back to all his projects. And then I think about my own process. I think you think about digging deeper and thinking, okay, why do I connect to the story? Why do I, what is it about me that is drawn to this? Because I think when you start out, you're so focused on, I want to make good films. I want to make the good product. And so you put all your emphasis into the product. When I think what makes really great work is when I remind myself to look within and see, okay, why do I connect to this? Like, what, I didn't have to make On the Clock. I remember I actually turned down the script because I was like,
just like you turned down USC.
I just turned down everything and then it works out. That's my career strategy. But I remember reading it and my friend wrote the script and she was like, I think you'd be really good for it. And I it just felt too simple. I was like, this just feels too easy. And then I remember going back to the script and I was like, okay, why do I connect to this so much? And I was just thinking about my own mom and my own siblings and thinking about the sacrifices they made for me and all the things they did. And I was crying. I was like, oh my gosh. And I remember calling my mom and being like, Mom, thank you for everything you've done for me. She's like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? But it's that kind of going inward and understanding, okay, what is the emotional connection to the story and doing everything that I can through conversations with my actors, with the crew, and trying to distill that like emotional energy and connection that I felt and communicating that emotional power to my collaborators. So I think when Lin-Manuel talks about Hamilton, he's talking about not Alexander Hamilton, who's a boss ass dude. He's talking about, oh, I'm an immigrant. I know what it's like to struggle. I know what it's like to have to fight and be underestimated. And those are the kind of things that he brings into that story. So I think that's why it moves people, because it moves the creator first. And I think what helps in my growth is like when I think about each project I'm doing, okay. And I think that's why, especially when directors start out, they tend to write their own material because it's like, it's the most personal thing to them. Yeah. And so when you're able to, you know, dig deep and really find like, why am I emotionally connected to this story? You're able to, and it still takes practice, but when you're able to find those emotional beats in yourself and communicate it, especially for filmmakers, like when you have so many other people working on your project, I actually really do envy like, writers and like kind of more one woman or person art forms, because it's like you don't need to talk to 30 people plus to like make your project. You can just talk to yourself and maybe two other people. But with filmmaking, it's like there's so many people, especially with student film, no one's getting paid. We're not paying anybody. So it's like so it's like that added element of like, shit, how am I going to convince all these people to work for free for hours to make this thing? And I think it always comes back to, okay, why am I connected to this project? And that's something that I think has helped me in my future projects and what I gravitate towards and what I'm willing to spend time on.
That's amazing. I love that. So post graduation, like what now? Like, are you thinking about, are you doing internships? Clearly you're writing on your own scripts right now and trying to get those made. Like, you know, for me in the doc world, it's like, it's like freelance, like with commercial clients to make some money, try to freelance, like as a cinematographer on a documentary, try to just like become friends with people because everyone just hires their friends. And then all the time, you know, trying to make your own and develop your skills, and hopefully one of them, you know, pops, like one of our former Stanford classmates, Luke Lorenzen, you know, like he's someone who's like, had the, you know, had the skills at that point where he had his idea and he made it happen with Midnight Family. So yeah, like, how are you approaching your career right now?
Yeah. I think for me, I definitely see how people go about like freelancing and things like that, but I realize I feel more productive when I find something a bit more steady. So yeah. After graduating, I was an assistant at James Corden's production company.
Okay.
And the hours were long, the pay was not great, but I was able to just have something steady. That consistency of income was really helpful to just kind of be like, okay, evenings, all right, weekends, I'll do X, Y, Z. Like I shot one of my short films. I'm not proud of this, but it's in the past. But I remember I first got hired and like I was supposed to shoot a short film a month later, like during the week. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna figure this out. And I was like, I just told them I was on vacation. Like I just like took the days off and lied.
Yeah.
While I was shooting my short film. I was very lucky that I had a boss who was really supportive of me and knew that I wanted to direct. And when I signed with CAA, I actually signed with them in July and was like going on general meetings, kind of just like sneaking out of work. But then fortunately my boss was like, I told her and she was like, yeah, like want to support you, definitely. So I was with them all the way till March. I didn't lose my job because of COVID. It just happened like my time at the company ended and then COVID hit. So I was planning on just chilling anyway. I was planning on just writing and then COVID was like, you are really going to stay home.
No going back on that chilling plan.
Yeah. So I guess right now I'm just kind of like, let's just focus on writing. And one of my friends, she sent me a graphic where it's like, think of this time as like an artist residency. Mm. Where you're getting your unemployment checks,
right?
Not spending any money, and just focus on like your own work. And I'm like, okay, so I'm just watching a lot of films. There's a lot of movies that I have yet to see that I should have seen. So I'm like watching a lot of that and writing a lot and just still working on my projects like remotely. So like one of my shorts, like we wrapped like a couple months ago and just been doing editing and color and sound all remotely, which has been a big pain. But I'm grateful that we shot everything before this happened because, I mean, people are talking about going back into production and shoots are happening, but you need to have the resources to do that because you need to spend more money on like hand sanitizer and PPE and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, and I'm actually working on pitching some ideas to some folks who are like really interested in kind of contained storytelling right now. They're like, what kind of stories can you tell through Zoom or through social
media? Oh, interesting.
Sets?
Yeah.
So I'm literally like pitching some ideas to people being like, hey, like these are some stories that we could shoot literally in our homes.
Remotely. Oh, wow. Very cool.
Yeah. So that's interesting. We'll see how that goes. But and I wrote a script that could be done in a house. So like if the company likes it, they'll give us money and hopefully we'll just like go to a home somewhere and just like quarantine and just like shoot a movie in a house. Like,
yeah.
That sort of contained stuff. But I think it depends from person to person. But for me, I think just having a steady like 9-to-5 while I like kind of do my own thing has worked for me. Because I don't really have freelanceable skills. Like I'm not really into cinematography and I was an editor and I just don't like editing that much to like make a living off it. So it's like, okay, let me just be an assistant or do something more day jobby in the industry. Yes, it'll be a lot more time, but it gives me that kind of peace of mind to free up my mind to work on my other projects because I'm like, okay, I know money's coming in every week. And so I'll just do that. And when I'm in a position to like actually make something, I'll just like take the time off and make the thing and then continue that. So it's definitely a balancing act for sure. But
yeah. Well, props to you on the hustle.
Yeah.
And props to you.
And the good thing is, I think in film school is tough because it's like, okay, like you have all this training, you did all this stuff. What now? And I think, I mean, USC fortunately has an industry kind of placement program. So they like really do try to help their students to find work. So that's been helpful. And I had internships and things like that. But I think what's been the most helpful is like, I think my first job was through a Stanford friend. Like there was a Facebook group and like someone posted and I was like, oh, right. So yeah, there's something to be said about keeping in touch with friends and just seeing what's out there. But yeah, it's a bit challenging, but the good news is we don't have to pay off our student loans right away. So
<That's>
you put that thing on deferment forever.
Well, I mean, I've thought a lot about it in the last month or so when there's been a lot of conversations about, I mean, who is telling stories? Like who is in control of narrative? What does representation and diversity look like in these industries?
Yeah.
And I've thought about it from the perspective of like, you know, people who are choosing to go into careers in filmmaking or journalism, which is my background, because like, first off, you're looking at, you know, going into an industry where there aren't a lot of jobs, especially the journalism world. You know, like the freelance landscape is super tough. And for people who are coming from backgrounds where they don't have the kind of like support that, say, I have with my family, where I can like live at home comfortably with my parents while I'm like making my own projects, people that don't have the luxuries that I do, it can be very hard to like get their foothold in the industry. I'm curious on that question of race and diversity in the filmmaking world. What conversations are happening that you've been interested in and kind of bringing up when you've been doing Q&As on the panels like that?
Yeah, it's wild because I'm glad we're having conversations about it, and I think it's definitely moving in the right direction. I think for me personally, I have to look inward and think about, okay, what can, because it feels like, oh, the industry. And yes, Disney, Warner Brothers, all those studios, they could be doing more, but like, that's not on me to think about those people. I have to think about kind of like, okay, who's around me? And I think about my team. Like, I think about the fact that I have a white agent and a white lawyer. Ooh. So I remember this manager was interviewing me and I was like, she was a white woman. I'm like, okay. I literally had to be like, sorry, I can't work with you because I want to be intentional about the diversity of my team. And I was like, that's scary to like turn that down, you know? So just thinking about, especially as creatives, like who, because we're a business. When you're an artist or in the industry, it's like, okay, you're a business. You have to think about who's on your team. And if all your team are white, okay. So yeah. I have to think, be very kind of like, oof, intentional about, okay, yes, I may be telling these diverse stories, but are my department heads diverse? Are the publicists I'm talking to diverse? Like just being very intentional about uplifting and talking to diverse folks.
Yeah. Yeah, it extends much further than beyond like who's the director or who's the cinematographer. It's like all those layers that happen to going into making these things a reality.
Yeah. And I think I had a Q&A with Rick Famuyiwa, who's big director, and he was basically saying like, yeah, we just need people to hire us. Like it's really, and I mean, of course there's more of the conversation of like hiring and then making those spaces like warm and welcoming and empowering, like inclusion and stuff. But it's like, when you think about, okay, who gets their first like opportunity, we have to talk about the fact that someone like Luke Lawrenson is able to make a documentary in Mexico because he has like support around him. Are we building those kind of support systems for artists of color? And I think definitely right now, especially with COVID, there's been a lot of like artist funds and grants and things like that. But it's like, if you don't have a home to like crash at for a bit, like how are we supporting our artists at the ground level? financially. I think that's the number one thing, because it's so easy to be like, oh, I'll mentor you, da, da, da. But it's like, okay, how are you going to actually financially support artists and stories, diverse stories? Because it takes money and resources to make these stories happen, to support these artists. And so unless you can say Black Lives Matter, you can say all the things, but if you're not doing the work, it's literally not going to change anything. So I think every organization, every person, whether you're a creative or an executive or a studio head, just really thinking about day to day, what behaviors am I a part of that are contributing to larger divides and setbacks for creatives of color. And it feels like it's hard to do, because you think like, oh, but it's like, no. Like, think about every step of the process and take ownership and be mindful of it. Because until you do the inner work of like, okay, what am I doing? How can I do better? Nothing's going to change. And I try to do it in my own way. And I think the people with more power and resources are doing that more. But I mean, we'll see. There's the whole conversation about like police and stuff. It's like, how are we depicting police in Hollywood? And it's like, oh my god, it's a whole thing. But I think ultimately that exercise of, you know, self-reflection and thinking critically is a great first start.
And I read something recently from a woman of color in the documentary space, and she was talking about both journalism and documentary, this idea that I said earlier, which was like, people hire their friends, they hire people they know. And for me, as I'm thinking about like kind of equality, inclusion in the long term of my career, like, to me, you know, I'm trying to think about this starting now. And I think for me, it starts with like finding documentarians who look different than me, that think different than me, and like just investing and saying like, hey, like, how's it going? Like, love your work. And just like connecting as people, and thinking about developing those relationships over time, so that like when I am in the position to say, oh, I have a little bit of money to hire a producer, or I have a little bit of money to bring on a cinematographer, that the network of people who I am close with and have relationships with are different than just like the Stanford soccer team, or like my journalism program, or like, you know, so that's something that I'm thinking about for sure. And I also got to say, like, recently it's been cool to see people turning to movies, both narrative and documentary, to kind of fill in gaps that the education system has left. That's been really heartening to see, of just like how vital a role that our industries or our art form.
Yeah.
I don't like the word industries. That's our art forms play there.
Yeah, there's so many amazing documentaries and narrative films that even I like, I'm like, you know, you feel like, oh yeah, I'm woke, but it's like, no, there's always more to learn. There's always more to experience. And 100% I agree with that. I mean, I feel like everyone needs to watch, I feel like it's required viewing to watch 13th. Mm-hmm. I think everyone should see that.
Yeah, amazing.
Because it's like, it just breaks it down powerful. So beautifully and so powerfully. So so props to like, those platforms like Netflix and Hulu, they're like, here's the Black Lives Matter collection.
Well, before we wrap up the episode, thanks so much for taking so much time. I wrap with my last question, quickly, where can people find you if they want to follow you and your work?
Yeah, I am on Instagram at tayo.shoes, and On the Clock is on Amazon Prime, so you can just search.
Go check it out. It's amazing. Bar,
and then my website's tayoamos.com, and
cool.
I have a newsletter too, so.
Amazing. Well, I'll have you send me the links to the newsletter and stuff, because I'll drop those in the show notes for people.
Yeah, sounds great.
And then the last question of the show, which I end with every episode, is just one last piece of advice that you would give people who want to become better storytellers and in any genre that they work in.
Yeah. For people who really want to make storytelling a career, I would encourage them to create a creative process that allows you to tap in on a daily basis. For some people, that means meditation. For some people, that means writing 5 pages when you wake up. For me, it means prayer and exercise. Just creating a system that you kind of a storyteller self-care kind of thing, where you really have a way to tap into yourself that kind of prompts you to delve in and tell stories in a way that are, you know, healthy for your well-being, because it takes a lot out of you as a person and as a spiritual vessel. So being able to find a system to do that will make the process more bearable, because it's a long journey and it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Oh, I love that. Amazing advice. Tayo Amos, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Austin.
That's it for episode 43 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much to Tayo Amos for joining the show and to you for listening. Make sure to go follow Tayo on social and check out her Amazon Prime short, On the Clock. I put links to all of that in the show notes. Also in the show notes is the link to sign up for my monthly newsletter. Yes, I send out a monthly newsletter which gives me the space to do some deeper reflection on things happening in the storytelling world, or give you some more behind the scenes details about my process and what I'm going through on my journey. So I hope you will check that out. And if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving a rating and review of the podcast on Apple Podcasts, and reach out to me on social at Austin Meyer Films to let me know what you thought of this episode. I love hearing feedback from listeners about what resonated with you and who you'd like to hear me interview in the future. And with that, I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Until then, go out and tell some stories.